listening to Omnis Protocol. I am Charles, also known as Omnis, and my guest this week is Pat Dunford, or as his co-host likes to refer to him, the Doctor Strange of Marvel Crisis Protocol. Pat, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So does that nickname truly feel right for you? Are you the Doctor Strange of Marvel Crisis Protocol?
We took the Marvel personality test, and that's what it came out as. And if that's not right, then I don't know what would be.
I could totally see you sitting at a table and just like using the time stone and going through all of the possibilities and be like, I have calculated your chances to win this game. And
yeah, I'm certainly not complaining with the title. It's complimentary, so I'll take it.
Absolutely. All right. So this episode, I specifically wanted to pick a topic that would be great for Pat. Obviously, Pat, you have a huge history with high level play in a variety of games. And without like going through your whole list of accolades, at the very least, you can just say you won the world championship for War Machine and Hordes twice in a row. Like that in itself is huge.
Yeah, that's definitely my biggest gaming accomplishment and one that I'm really, really proud of. I've been playing competitive games since, I don't know, about 20 years at this point. War Machine heavily for the last 10. I love that game a lot. I love the community. And I was really proud to get to that highest level.
For sure, as anyone would be. It takes a huge amount of skill, a huge amount of having the right mindset, and a little bit of luck at the very least. But it's a long road. And I think this topic is perfect for you because what we're going to do, both as competitive players that have kind of jumped into this relatively new game, and just when I was at Las Vegas Open, I kept every competitive War Machine player was asking me, you know, like, how do you feel about Marvel Crisis Protocol? And I had these questions and I'm like, I'm still in my honeymoon phase. You got to give me some time because right now it's just an exciting new game and I need some more time to dive in and answer these questions honestly and not just because I'm enjoying a new product. So the focus for this one is I went out and I asked some people who do not play Marvel Crisis Protocol that either used to play War Machine or currently play War Machine and played at a very, very high level. And I just said, what sort of questions would you want to have answered to help you gauge whether or not this is the kind of game that you would enjoy sinking your teeth into and discovering all of the depths and intricate aspects? And so these questions are all from friends of mine. So just a quick shout out to Jaden, Jason, and Anthony. Thank you guys so much for helping. Don't know if you'll ever end up playing Marvel Crisis Protocol, but maybe. We'll see.
But maybe Pat, we can convince them.
Yeah, exactly. I think I've got one of them convinced so far, but we'll see about the other two. But we're just going to kind of go through their questions back and forth and try to give our honest answer about what the experiences are like playing MCP. And I think we'll start with kind of an easy one, Pat. Do you think that there are any over or under-tuned characters in Marvel Crisis Protocol?
You said that's easy. I don't think it's that easy at all. one of the things that's really funny is every time this comes up in Discord chats or Facebook posts, people post tier lists on podcasts, everyone has very different opinions about which characters are overtuned and which characters are undertuned in particular.
Definitely.
Like, there's definitely a consensus on some characters are really good and popular, but people have very different ideas about which characters are broken, either for better or worse. So that's pretty cool. I think, look, it's a kind of Marvel Crisis Protocol is a game where so much of the rules is on the character's card. I don't think right now there are any characters that are massively overtuned, but I could see the potential for that existing in future as more and more releases happen. And as for undertuned, personally don't think anything is too far below the curve, but I have seen some people complain about characters such as Hulk being a little bit below. What do you think about that?
So I think there's a lot of interesting points there. But say, for example, a shout out to another podcast, Turn Zero Gaming, their particular gaming meta, their like focus list, like the list to beat is utilizing Hulk. And whether or not I agree with that isn't necessarily important. It's that there are absolutely metas that are taking a character that you thought Hulk would be a best example as potentially an undertuned character. And there are other communities right now that are saying this is part of one of the best lists that we're all trying to figure out how to beat.
Yes.
And that's absolutely true in this case right now.
Yeah, it really is. And actually, I don't personally believe that Hulk is undertuned. I've had a lot of success with him. There really isn't that much consensus. And just, you mentioned Turn Zero Gaming. Oh my gosh, that tier list. I could not disagree more with so many of their inclusions.
Oh yeah, I'm in the same place. And I think that was intentional.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what you're playing against is going to start shifting some of those things. I probably would have agreed with them at the time that Shuri is potentially the kind of the top of the list. But even as I've started playing in some other crisis, say like Deadly Meteors, where she isn't as strong, and I've started to feel like maybe she isn't the top the way that I thought she was. And there are other characters that are starting to edge her out as my most played or most important character on a roster. So even things that I thought weeks ago are still evolving. And it's really hard to say. I think my core answer would be there are definitely a range. They're not all exactly the same, obviously. And there are some that seem slightly more consistent and can easily fit into almost any roster, like, say, Black Panther. But I wouldn't actually say he's overtuned. He never feels overpowered. He just feels consistently good. Does that kind of make sense to you, Pat?
Yeah, it does. And I think it's worth mentioning here or pointing out that as players, we do want characters to have a variance in their power level. If every character was functionally the same in terms of power level, then our decisions as to how which characters be included in rosters would be much less meaningful. And it would be how do I want to phrase this? What I want to say is understanding why characters are weak or strong and how to apply that strength or overcome that weakness is one way that you can display mastery of a game. Don't want all of the characters to be very flat in terms of power level. You want there to be some variation so that as a player, you can understand and take advantage of that.
For sure. And I think a good example of that would be, say, like comparing Vision and Valkyrie, right? They are two different threat levels, but at the same time, you have Valkyrie, who's all physical attacks and gives you access to a strong throw. And Vision has primarily, his main attack is energy and gives you access to a great throw. And just on a simple level, you might go, I need another character that can throw, but I need an energy attacker. And so there are little subtle things like that can still shift one character's level of importance compared to another.
Oh, for sure. And there's so much variation in characters and there's so much depth on a character card in regards to all of their different defensive stats, attacks, superpowers. You're never just choosing between two very simple options and picking the most powerful.
It actually feels like it's only getting harder and harder to make these character decisions.
Mm-hmm. It's real tough.
Okay. So I think the core answer to this question is there are still some power level differences, but it doesn't feel huge. It feels like there are going to be situations where you feel like this character is better than another character, but even say like Dr. Octopus, which is kind of maligned, maybe maligned's not even the right word, but maybe one of the character who is picked up a little bit less, you still have people that are playing them in their primary tournament rosters, and he's got an affiliation coming down the road, so he might become super popular here in a few months. So I think it's all within the reasonable margin that we would want, at least so far.
Oh, I definitely agree.
Okay. Well, Pat, what question do you want to do next?
So next question, how rewarding is your spacing, placement, and positioning to the tactical advantage during a game?
So this particular question hits home for me because I personally feel like placement and positioning is one of my stronger aspects as a player, and I feel like it is extremely rewarding in Marvel Crisis Protocol, even if we're comparing it to a game like, say, War Machine, where often the scenario elements are very large, where they, at the smallest, they're like a 9-inch diameter, something like that. That's, you know, the area around a flag or something like that. In this game, you have a 1-inch around a particular piece that you're trying to manage, and you have multiple of those on the table, and it is a little bit more difficult to get things like cover. It does not come up that often. It's a little bit harder to block line of sight, and you can end up in very delicate situations that where you put your character may leave you struggling to get around a building or setting your opponent up for a really great throw. So my instinctual answer to this is it is incredibly important, probably more so than a lot of the other games that I've played in the past.
Yeah, I definitely agree. It's critically important. And I think it comes up pretty much every time I place a model in this game. I'm turning on that part of my War Machine brain that thinks about placement in relation to other models and scenario elements. It matters every single time you move a model, every time you check ranges. And one thing that I've found demoing the game to more experienced wargamers is as you play the game, you notice that straight away. You will almost certainly have in your first game some moments where you think, huh, if I just position my model an inch to the left, I could have avoided this whole mess.
Right. There's times when you're getting about to get pushed away and then you check the angle and you're like, oh, there is either the perfect angle for the push or it doesn't exist. And you're like, oh, if I had just moved like 4 millimeters this way, I could have stopped that push completely or set up for a great one, one or the other. And there are so much movement compared to the average game with all of the pushes and throws. It feels a bit more like movie combat than I think a lot of other games do because of how much movement there is and how much you're dealing with getting thrown at some point or something like that. So, yeah, I agree. It's a huge part of the game.
Yeah, for sure. One of the things that I really, really like about the game is because of the focus on scenario and the ample ways to move opposing characters, it is a game that you can win without beating up your opponent. In theory, you can win the game without ever damaging your opponent if your positioning and your placement is really, really good. So I think probably of all of the miniatures games I've played, I'd say maybe Marvel Crisis Protocol is the most rewarding for placement and positioning. It's certainly up there with War Machine as being one of the most rewarding.
I agree with that assessment. And just to like throw out a little anecdote, my last game, not the last game, the second to last game I played, there was a turn in Deadly Meteors where I had Thor double move and just throw Black Panther off of a Crisis so that he could try to switch the origin bomb. And my opponent was questioning me afterwards and saying, you just used your highest threat character, your biggest character on the table to do no damage. And the way that things played out, I think he only netted over the course of two or three turns doing maybe one damage to Black Panther. And at the end, he's like, I just don't think you did enough with Thor. I'm like, no, that was exactly what I needed him to do. He kept Black Panther busy and he kept moving Black Panther off of the Crisis that he could just do without a dice roll potentially. And that was the right play for me, and that was not focusing on dazing characters, but focusing on throwing someone around.
Oh, yeah, for sure. You've just made me think about how all of this works when you have this alternating activation turn sequence, and how sometimes you want to be the first player to act, sometimes you want to be the last, but so much of that is also about taking advantage of what's offered to you through moving opposing characters, right? And it can be so rewarding to be the last person to activate, get into that spot and throw the opponent away. It's a classic game-winning move.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's something that any character that can do that, it's important to keep that in the back of your mind. So, All right, well, I think we agree. It is critically important to this game that you absolutely need to be thinking about your exact landing spot, because those sort of subtle decisions can make or break a game. But Pat, how do you feel about dice in the game? How impactful are the dice rolls over the course of the average game?
So the dice in this game are definitely different to a lot of others, radically different from War Machine. Personally, have a pet peeve. I don't know if you know this, but I cannot stand novelty dice. I loathe custom dice that have like replacements for numbers, and I dislike games that use their own dice over things like D6s. To be honest, D&D even bugs me with like D20s. That dice is ridiculous. I'm such a dice purist. It's basically D6s or nothing. And so for me, coming into Marvel, the custom dice were the biggest hurdle that I had to overcome. But as I started playing with them, I realized, oh, actually, these aren't too bad. The dice math is obfuscated compared to D6s, I would say. It's harder. Yeah, it's definitely harder to know what your odds are. But that also adds a bit of charm to the game. And it does, like, So this is maybe a bit of a tangent, but bear with me. One of the things that I've seen people criticize Marvel Dice for is because it's harder on the fly to work out probabilities. People dislike that because they can't make an informed decision. Is that feedback that you've heard before?
I think I've heard that that assessment. I think that's fair to say in some cases.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people necessarily feel that way. But when we're talking to our fellow competitive-minded gamers, I think there's probably a higher percentage of people that dislike the idea that you can't predict the outcomes of the random number generator before you apply it. But my opinion is that doesn't change the game being skillful. It just changes the skill you need. And so rather than the skill being how good am I at working out probabilities, the skill is how good am I at estimating the probability from an obfuscated set of data, and how good am I at coming up with backup plans for if this doesn't work?
No, I 100% agree. I think something I used to talk about in War Machine a lot was that I felt like I had a good skill for determining the worst case scenario and thinking about, like, okay, if I do this thing and it goes bad, what happens? Mm-hmm. And I think having that sort of outlook in Marvel Crisis Protocol is important. And thinking about how things can go badly, because you do see a little bit more spiking one way or the other. And I think how you plan for that and, you know, kind of integrate it into your overall plan ends up being really important. So I agree that while I do think the dice math is a little harder to figure out and it does have a little bit more variance than, say, something like War Machine, it does so in a very interesting way, more so than what I expected.
I definitely agree with that. And then on the subject of variance, the dice can give you very big spikes, and they do that with more consistency than in War Machine. And also because you're playing a skirmish game, it tends to be that each dice roll is often more important than in a larger scale miniatures game where more dice are being rolled over the course of your playtime.
One thing I want to throw out here that was one of my big pet peeves in War Machine is when you have, say, like an expensive solo that if that one ranged attack hits it and it's like 50-50, you know, you're like needing 9 or a 10 on 3 dice to hit. And if you hit, you probably take that piece off the table. That was always something that frustrated me quite a bit in War Machine, where you end up in these 50-50 situations. And if they get it, it's a great move. And if they don't get it, then they just wasted this activation. And I will at least say that it feels like that doesn't come up nearly as much in Marvel Crisis Protocol because of the healthy side versus injured side situation, where you're rarely in a situation where right off the bat someone takes, you know, a 50-50 play to try to get something off the table and then it's completely gone. And so the dazed mechanic does feel like it mitigates some of that variance a bit.
Yeah, definitely. I was going to use a similar example from my days playing 40K back in fourth edition Warhammer 40,000, where so often you would be firing single dice attacks against high value vehicles. And if you rolled a 6, that vehicle would explode. And if you rolled any other number, not much would happen. And so you would just have these games that would be decided on the first turn because you rolled a 6 and you just accidentally killed the most valuable mod in your opponent's army before it got to do anything.
That sounds awful.
Oh, it really was. Yeah. You had some pretty bad games, potentially. And in the wrong circumstances, you could feel like you'd lost on the first turn. And you're right. The thing is, in Marvel Crisis Protocol, the dice are spiky, but there are mechanics built into the game that mitigate the impact of those spikes. You mentioned the dazed mechanic. That's a prime example. The other one that I think works so well for this is the power mechanic, where your characters get power that makes them more effective in the game according to how much damage they take. So it acts as a perfect comeback mechanic. If I attack your model and I spike a really high damage roll, then your retaliation against me is going to be much better than it otherwise would be.
I completely agree. And I actually think this plays into the next question that we're going to get to. Do you want to hop into the next question, or do you have more to say on this topic?
No, let's do it.
Okay.
The next question. A fundamental aspect of many games comes down to resource management. How does MCP handle it, and is it done in a fresh and thought-provoking way?
The easy answer, I think, is yes. But to come back to what you were just saying about the mechanic of taking damage and then getting more power to use your abilities is one of the more interesting aspects of this game, where obviously you need to generate power to use your best attacks and use your best abilities, like, say, throwing Black Panther off a crisis or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so you're often put in a position where you're making very subtle decisions about how you spend your power, but there are also deciding moments in a game where attacking an enemy character may give them the key power to allow them to win the game. And there are times where you just don't want to attack someone because you don't want to give them one or two more power. And that feels extremely comic booky to me, where there are times, there are always moments where you're like, well, we can't attack that thing with this because it's just going to get more powerful. And that absolutely happens in the game, and you have to factor that into your decision making.
Yeah, it's really cool. I love how the power mechanic enables comic book and cinematic moments in the game. They just happen so naturally. They're really, really fun. And I guess that, for me, answers the point about it being fresh. The games I like the most are games where the mechanics work really well with the gameplay. They synergize together. I think in War Machine, Focus and Fury Allocation did that. It made you feel smart, and it made you feel like you were living the experience of focusing your power through a machine. And I think in Marvel, the power mechanic is just perfect. I love it. And another thing that I'd add is that is not the only resource, right, in Marvel Crisis Protocol. There's actually a huge number of resources to manage.
Right, you've got tactics cards, you've got the activations, you have the health on characters or the stamina on characters. There's just tons of little things that you're all going to manage differently, and that's going to play a huge effect on how efficient you were in a particular game.
Yes, it's interesting because some of these things will happen in every game, but also I think we're starting to see that you can have a focus on different strategies where you are prioritizing one resource over the other, right? And I'm thinking about, for example, a focus on trying to overwhelm the opposing team with damage to try and reduce the number of activations they have over the course of the game by Daisy and KO and characters, versus trying to conserve your power and use that to move opposing characters and win the game quickly.
Yes, definitely. And it's very interesting because as you're trying to take one resource away from your opponent, like, say, activations, which are very key in this game, you also, at the same time, end up giving them power. And so they end up kind of gaining more of a different resource as you're trying to work out your plan of reducing their activations. It is incredibly subtle, I think, at times, where it's difficult to know the right move. Where do I want to attack him? Do I not? What is the right decision? And you have some really thought-provoking moments. So I think the key answer to this question is absolutely yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I just want one last thing that I wanted to tie in here. We mentioned before how the dice impact the game, and we said these two things are related. But I think you could be in such an interesting spot where you could be looking at your character about to make an attack on an opposing character, and you could be thinking, okay, if I roll low, this doesn't do what I want it to do. It's not enough effect. I've wasted my activation. If I roll just right, I get exactly what I want. But if I roll too high, then I give them too much power, and then I'm in trouble again. And I also don't know what my odds are of any of those things. So I've got to make a gut call. And I personally really enjoyed that about the game. I think it's super fun.
There have been more and more interesting moments where you're trying to think about these plays and how it's going to play into the longer. And it, to a certain extent, I feel like your ability to adapt is also important. I know this doesn't directly correlate into any of our questions, but I think your ability to adapt to how these things are happening is really important, because you do, to a certain extent, just kind of go, that character is going to attack this character. I know the rough odds of what happens here, but the odds of it going high and the odds of it going low are actually kind of similar. And so I have to just see how things happen, and I need to adapt to that situation. And your ability to adapt ends up being really important.
I think you've summed it up perfectly. So, shall we move on to the next question?
I think so. I'm kind of glad that you have to answer this one first, because this is a little challenging. Is there enough depth to the scenarios and crisis to challenge and keep the games interesting for the more tournament-minded players?
So, I feel like right now there is. When we say tournament-minded, okay, I should just throw a disclaimer. Because of that point, I'm only thinking about the normal way of playing Crisis. I'm excluding things like Ultimate Encounters. Those are awesome, but I don't think they're made with tournaments in mind.
Which is fine.
Yeah, no, it's great. And yeah. I just like to point out that there's way more that you can get out of this game than just playing tournaments. But the crisis that we have right now for tournaments, I think they're fine. I think they are just about enough to keep things fresh and challenging. But I fully expect that as more cards get released and added to the pool, then I'll be much more certain that there's plenty of depth and plenty of challenge.
I agree. And I think to avoid totally fanboying over Atomic Mass Games for this entire podcast, I'm going to throw out one counterpoint here, because you may not know this yet, but you and I have both recorded episodes kind of on this topic that have not released at the time that we're recording this, but will both have released before this episode releases, talking about building rosters and teams that are specifically set up to take advantage of certain crisis. Mm-hmm. And that would be certain scenarios. And I will say, instinctively at the moment, it does feel like there are going to be certain teams that are advantaged when they get to pick the fully optimal crisis for themselves. Now, maybe that changes as we get more characters and more crisis options and things like that, that advantage gets mitigated. But that is something that we're both at least keeping our eye on at the moment.
Yeah, I do think that right now, some crises match particular teams really well, and other teams don't have a crisis to call their own. I'm pretty confident from what we've seen that that will probably change over time. I think if we discussed this 6 weeks ago, I wouldn't feel this way, because without the release of Thor and Star-Lord and their two crisis, I don't think the pool would be deep enough for me to feel like different teams had specializations in the crisis pool. So as it gets deeper, I expect that everyone will have a lot of depth in how they pick their crisis.
I think I agree with that assessment. And as you get the greater mix of character options, that's only going to make it more and more challenging. But it is just something to keep in mind that there may hit a point in this as a competitive game where you have to keep in mind that, let's just say, Wakanda playing in Gamma Wave can be a very significant advantage for them. And you need to be thinking about what happens when you get that matchup, which I don't really think is fundamentally different from other games that people play in tournaments and that sort of thing. You always are going to have to think about certain situations and have a plan for them. And so only time will tell if it's more significant than that sort of experience in other games.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Another thing that I would urge people to keep in mind is it's still very early days for this game in regards to scenario. And
4 months? We're only like 4 months in.
I know, right? It's crazy. It feels like so much has happened already, but it's not been a lot of time. And I think it's fair to say that in most miniatures games, when you look at the competitive scene, it tends to be that they have stricter guidelines for scenario play than in normal kind of pick up and play games between friends. And we're not at that point yet with MCP, but from what we've seen, there's no reason why we couldn't have more specific rules if that was something that the community wanted.
Absolutely. I'm going to throw out a quick anecdote here for the listeners. I don't think I've actually said this on my show. Pat, I assume that you probably at some point have either heard of or played Magic the Gathering.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I was playing Magic the Gathering Arena today.
Fair enough. So Richard Garfield, the original designer of Magic the Gathering, is based out of the area that I live. And there was a point when I worked at a game store, which is where he shopped for games. So I had the privilege of having quite a few discussions with him about the games that he was working on. And at one point, he came in while I was playing a war game. And he and I got into a discussion where his biggest concern about miniatures games and war games was that there wasn't an element that forced the engagement. And you can even see that in the evolution of his rules in card games, where Magic the Gathering didn't ever really force engagement. But in his more recent game, Keyforge, you can, if your opponent doesn't engage with you, you can kind of win playing solitaire. And so he kind of incorporated those aspects into his card game design. But this is really, in my opinion, the first miniatures game where the scenario element is a completely core concept built into the base design of a game, not an afterthought, like, say, not that I want to throw War Machine under the bus, because they've always kind of had some scenarios, but the core scenarios that are all used are not something that were there from the beginning, and there's stuff that evolves from year to year. It's not a core element, it is a tournament element kind of added a little after the fact. And so I think it is both an advantage and something that they're going to have to keep their eye on, that we have this designed from the get-go to be a game that encourages engagement and makes the action happen.
Yeah, I think you're definitely right about that. It's a game where when I'm demoing it, you kind of have to explain how Crisis worked first, and you kind of have to have them in your game because otherwise it doesn't function. Whereas if I'm demoing most other games, I won't worry about that, right? I'll just line up two armies and have people duke it out. Yeah, so for sure, you're spot on. Yeah, nicely said.
All right, well, I think we can probably hop into the next question.
Cool. Next question. How common are mirror matches and character overlapping games? How does that impact your enjoyment of a game?
It's an interesting question because, say, again, we're comparing a lot of things to War Machine because that's our background. But also, I'll throw out Star Wars minis. Back in the day, I used to play the Wizards of the Coast Star Wars minis game a lot. And you absolutely had mirror matches all the time in that. They had a huge issue with, generally, their big tournament of the year at Gen Con. In many cases, more than half of the field was slight variations on the same list. Mm. And so something like that, extremely common. War Machine, probably not very common. But every once in a while, especially in like top 8 events or top 16 events, you may run into a mirror match. It's going to be hard to answer this right now because LVO, we did our kind of our first tournament, and I ended up playing an exact mirror in round 2 and round 3. But that was an exact mirror in the characters that were played. However, I chose to play a single affiliation roster, and so my tactics cards ended up being very different. And I felt like my tactics cards actually gave me the advantage, where they could make the same team that I was making, and they felt like it was the right team for the table at that moment, but I did not feel like they had the more optimal tactics cards. For example, the best one that I could use is I had brought Venom, and because I was single affiliation, I was able to fit in Lethal Protector, his character-specific card, and they were not able to. And that ended up being a really important factor in Game 2, and not quite to the same extent, but still important in Game 3 as well. So even if you have a mirror match where you're playing the exact same characters, it is pretty unlikely that you'll also be playing the exact same tactics cards, which can have as big, if not a larger, effect.
Yeah, I agree with that. I just thinking myself, I don't think I've ever had a mirror match of this game. No, not once. And I expect that perhaps over time, as the meta evolves and as people consolidate their opinions, it might be that popular lists proliferate and we start to see more mirror matches. At the same time, though, that's going to be mitigated by the stream of new releases and the fact that any team can incorporate any new models should hopefully keep things very fresh.
Yeah, it definitely seems like that's going to be the case. And I will say, even though I've played in some mirrors and say, even in the average game, it's not that weird to go, oh, well, we're basically playing two totally different affiliations, but we both have Zemo and Thor. But they're not necessarily facing off against each other. There's a lot of aspects going on the table. You know, depending on which one gets hit by an attack may affect how much that particular character's impact on the table is. And I will say, in general, I haven't had mirror match situations detract from the enjoyment of the game. I will say the largest moment where I did feel like it was getting awkward was in the finals game at LVO, where we were playing the exact same team and we were finding that we both wanted to deploy basically the exact opposite of the opponent. So it was like, you deploy Venom over there and I end up deploying Venom like kitty cornered to that Venom. And we kept doing that deployment after deployment, which was very strange. And that, so I'd say that's probably the moment that it felt the weirdest. But I still very much ended up enjoying the game.
So that was a literal mirror match where you had all the same characters facing off opposite each other.
Almost. The first three characters deployed were like polar opposite, but then like the last couple deployments weren't quite polar opposite. But it was starting to feel that way at one point where like I was the person deploying second and I'm like, crap, I want to figure out a spot that's not the polar opposite to what he did. But I feel like it's the right decision. And it has to do with, well, if I deploy Shuri over here, you don't want that character opposite of Shuri. So I'm going to put this character on the opposite side now. And we're both kind of having some of that same mindset. And it had some laughing moments for sure.
Yeah, makes sense. I mean, I said I've never played mirror matches. Obviously, I've played with individual characters duplicated on both sides. That happens pretty frequently. And I think I agree with you, Charles, that for me, it doesn't impact my enjoyment of the game. I think it helps that we're playing in the Marvel universe and there's plenty of excuses for duplicate characters, you know, between like mind control, time travel, robots, Skrulls, alternate dimensions. It's never felt jarring to me, but I do know some players don't like that and would prefer to have straight up heroes versus villains and that kind of thing.
Well, and if you're not playing in a tournament, I know primarily we're talking about tournament play, but there have been absolutely games where I had someone over at my house and he didn't have any painted models. And I kind of specifically picked a team that'd be very different than his. And so that I would have enough stuff. I'm like, here, let's just play with all of my painted stuff. And I will give you all the models for your team. And I'm going to play something a little bit different just because that's what I'm in the mood for at the moment. And whenever you're just playing at a game night or playing at home or like, you can always do that.
Yeah, and then the other thing I'd say is I just recently did a Crisis Day event a couple of weeks ago, and everyone had pretty different ideas for what made an effective team. And there was obviously every affiliation was represented. Every affiliation was played. Some people had single affiliation rosters. Some people had dual affiliation rosters. So I think the opinions about which teams are good is as diverse as the opinions about which characters are good right now. So at least at this point, I don't think there's too much danger of mirror matches happening frequently.
To follow up on your point that you just made, I'm finding that my opinion is changing from week to week as well. Back around the time when Across the Bifrost, your podcast, was talking about single affiliation versus dual affiliation, and you kind of convinced yourself that single affiliation may be the right route, like literally during the podcast, you had started feeling one way, and as you were talking about it, you're like, I think I'm actually in the single affiliation camp. And at the time, I mean, I interact on your Discord quite a bit, I was definitely in the single affiliation camp. But now, after some recent games and some more specific strategies based on Crisis, I have now started leaning towards a dual affiliation roster to have something that focuses on a secure and have something that focuses on an extract. And now I'm leaning that direction. And who knows, a month from now, I could be back on the single affiliation roster. I really don't know. Yeah, it's just a lot to wrap your head around for options.
Oh, it's a huge amount. And I think it's going to be that because there's a huge variety of characters and there's a lot of different options for strategy, like I just don't think we're going to see mirror matches be as common. And as more and more characters come out, we're starting to see characters that act as soft counters to each other, so I think that should also help push things in different directions.
I agree, and I think that's all going to just be kind of a part of the game. And as we're as our thoughts evolve, I mean, we really have to give some credit to AMG here that we're at about, we're less than 30 models released in the game, something like that. And we have 4 months of game time. And every time I feel like I have started to fine tune and kind of get in, all right, this is the stuff that's starting to edge out and be more competitive. And then the next week, I'm not playing any of those characters. I'm blown away about how much that is happening. And so I have to like give some props to all of the AMG nerds, because it is kind of impressive that's happening with even the limited pool that we have now.
Yeah, for sure. I play everything, and every time I play a character, I'm like, oh, that character's pretty great. Maybe I should play them more often. And then I move on to the next, and the just cycle never stops.
Absolutely. I'm hitting a point where to carry all my terrain in my bag and mm-hmm. carry all the characters that I want to play to a game night, I'm having to take out a few characters because I just can't quite fit them all into my bag with all of the terrain. And it is becoming harder and harder to figure out which characters I don't, even one or two. It is so hard for me to say, I do not want to play these two characters. And that blows me away that I'm in that spot, because I very much in other games, it's been way easier for me to go, well, this stuff is not part of my competitive plan. This is fine. I don't need these. It is only getting more difficult.
Yeah, I think it's a happy consequence of the nature of the game, in that because it focuses on individual characters that are all unique, you just can't make such informed decisions about what you keep and what you cut as you might in more traditional war games, where you could immediately cut out whole sections of your roster because they don't match the kind of force you're trying to put together. So I agree, it's really great.
Well, I want to say one more thing before we probably get into our final question for this one, which is, I don't think we mentioned, because in this game, your roster is not your team. And that is a very important fundamental difference, where in most other games, you would bring in your list or your team, which is already fully constructed. This is what you're going to play. And maybe you get to choose between two different teams or two different lists, like in, say, War Machine. But in this, you basically are bringing a pool of characters that you can build from, and then you get to see what the table looks like and which crisis is on that table. You get to see that before you're picking your characters, which allows you to make very customized decisions. Like, just for example, maybe you want Spider-Man or Thor or Vision because of their mobility and their flight or wall crawler abilities because of the amount of terrain on the table, which can then make subtle changes. You're like, okay, well, I have this amount of points left and I need to fit in these elements. Which characters fulfill those elements the best at that threat level? And that makes it extremely interesting. And I think it makes it so more characters have value because of those unique threat amounts that different tables can create you wanting, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah, it really does. I think the diversity is going to keep on coming. I mean, that we might get to a point in the distant future. I could see a world where people have collectively created opinions about which lists are the best lists and people take the same roster. But as you said, even if that happens, you're not necessarily going to have straight mirror matches, because you might choose different characters from the rosters. Players might have different opinions about which characters to pick for a given crisis or terrain setup. And then I can imagine a situation where we get into a weird state where people are picking counter picks, right? And if you and I have the exact same characters, and we have our characters we want to use because we think they're the best, and then we have our counter picks to those, how are we going to choose which to play?
It's going to be very interesting. And I was just having a conversation with a local player who comes from a competitive background. I believe he even works in game design. And I was making a point to him that I thought, if you're going to see a lot of Black Panther and Shuri, that it's important to maybe include at least one element in your roster that'll allow you to have something that's difficult for Shuri to push off of a point. That could be Black Widow because of stealth. It could be Crossbones because if he takes one damage, he can walk that short move back. Or Vision, who could just straight up not be pushed at all. That might be an important aspect to integrate into the list. And then I used your most recent tournament list as a devil's advocate. I'm like, he won his tournament and he's a fantastic player. He included none of these elements. So I might also be totally wrong.
Yeah, I part of me does wish that I'd included Vision, but yeah, and it's because it's not just about how characters light up, right? It's also about how you use them, how your strategy plays out on the table, how the terrain looks. Like, if I'm playing against characters with lots of pushes, then I more often keep my characters base to base with each other or in front of terrain rather than trying to get cover so that they can't be pushed. And I play around it in that way as well.
And that's absolutely going to be something that we have to keep in mind through all of this. So, man, I hope this information ends up being as useful to the listeners as I feel like it is. So I'm enjoying this discussion quite a bit.
Me too.
So for kind of a final question, does the gameplay in Marvel Crisis Protocol facilitate really impressive events that feel calculated as opposed to something completely random that make for great storytelling after a game? And to elaborate on this just a little bit more, I'm talking about those moments where, say, you have an important tournament or something like that, and then in the final game, you come up with this tactical play that no one expected, and it makes for this great story. And I absolutely got those moments in War Machine. And this is not a pure competitive question, but it still factors into our enjoyment of that experience. Does it give you those cool moments to talk about later on? And so I thought this would be a great one to end on. So, Pat, what do you think? What's the answer to this question?
So I think it does. I think the cool moments are closely tied to iconic characters doing really cool things. And I think the game is really good at facilitating that. Every time you activate one of your characters, because of the way the dice work, there's the potential that they could have a spectacular activation. And my experience so far is trying to set up a really spectacular turn and trying to enhance it with support characters or tactics cards, rerolls, make it more reliable and more consistent is most commonly how I'm getting my good stories out of this game.
Yeah, and I want to elaborate on that I think the freedom that this game allows, as an American, me using the term freedom is kind of hilarious, but the freedom of how you determine the order of what a particular character does, because you have two actions that can be moves or attacks, and you have some abilities that are not actions, and you have tactics cards. And because you kind of have a complete freedom of which order you do those things, like, do I want to attack and then do a double move and then a throw? Do I want to move once, use one superpower, then move again and use a different superpower, and integrate a tactics card somewhere in there during that process? You have a lot of freedom to make that sort of decision. So I feel that absolutely facilitates that. And almost all of the moments that I have that I end up sharing this cool anecdote have very little to do with some crazy die roll. And they have everything to do with just how I chose to use a key character's activation to, facilitate some sort of win, or sometimes just a really cool cinematic moment for the hell of it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's no shortage of cinematic moments, that's for sure. They will come up in every game. Even if you're trying to avoid them, you just can't. That will
Yeah,
happen.
you probably couldn't avoid them.
And then I think, maybe to be very slightly critical on this point, I do think that you can also have times where you set up a cool plan and then dice fail you and you're awesome strategy to win the game falls apart. But honestly, isn't that true of every game? Like, we choose to have randomness in our games so that these things aren't totally reliable. So I can't really fault Marvel for that either.
Right. And the interesting thing, again, I'll throw back to LVO, where I had a moment where I moved up a Black Panther, and he's a pretty durable character, right? Like, on a general scale, he's a harder character to remove from the table. And my opponent just got lucky. And turn one, his last activation, he dazes Black Panther. One hit, he does six stamina worth of damage. And
Oh.
he kind of had this mindset of, like, do you just want to call it here? Like, that was a huge, crazy spike. And I'm like, no, we're playing this out. And I won that game. And because we've already mentioned it in the other moments, but because taking damage leads you to having a lot of power, which then means like at the start of the next turn, I get to do some really cool things with Black Panther because he's fully loaded on power. And he is a character that is fantastic at spending power. He has no shortage of impressive things to do. So even though I had this heartbreaking moment where I'm like, that should not have happened. The odds for that had to be below 2%. And it happened. So now what do I do? Which comes back to adapting to the situation and just going, this is what happened. What are we doing with this? Ends up being super fun and ends up kind of allowing for some of the better games.
I love your example. I think it's perfect. And you've made me think that, yeah, I think a lot of this is closely tied to the power mechanic. We already talked about the way resources work in this game and how integral it is. But so many rewarding plays are just thinking about how could I get the most out of my power? How could I have as efficient an activation with this character as possible? So I'm using every single point of power they have to maximum effect to achieve all the goals I need to swing things back in my favor.
And I'm going to do a shout out to one of your, again, another one of your prior episodes on Across the Bifrost, where you were talking about some of the more aggressive first turn plays that you should be considering. And one of the things that I have been thinking about since then is the aggressive plays and how to make them successful, but then how to capitalize on it if they are not successful in the traditional sense. Like, say you move across the board and you try to take their crisis token. And in the last episode, I brought up how even if Black Panther moves over there and takes it and then gets dazed, I now have one of the characters that has the greatest ability to spend power with a ton of power. And how will I, if I plan that into my initial positioning where, okay, Black Panther is here, even if they take him down, I want to be set up to do all sorts of counterplay if they daze him. What am I going to do with all of that power? And I want him positioned to factor in for that possibility, which kind of wraps us back around to all of the different points that we've been making. That is your ability to adapt, your ability to use those resources, and your ability to place factoring in those possibilities is all going to have a huge impact on how much you enjoy this as a tournament game or a, you know, competitive game.
Couldn't agree more. Game's great.
Yeah, absolutely. I had some of the same concerns that you did about the dice. And I will say, as I have been playing, I have only been enjoying it more so. And obviously, we're both podcast about it, so we probably should be enjoying it.
You'd hope so, wouldn't you?
All right. Well, Pat, it has been so much fun to have you on for the episode. I'm glad to finally have, you know, TT's better half on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, at least the one thing about all of us spending so much time at home, it's easier to schedule these calls to another country.
Yeah, it's a nice perk.
All right. Well, listeners, thank you for tuning in for another episode. Obviously, anytime that I can have Pat on, it will be a welcome experience. And thank you for supporting me on Patreon and getting to enjoy the bonus episodes for those of you that can do that. And if not, totally understand. We're all in different places. So any shares or any comments, feedback, I love all of it. And Pat also has been very active talking with all of his, I'm going to say fans. We're all Pat fans.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying the Discord. We have really fantastic conversations. And I'm trying to be as helpful as possible on Facebook as well.
Yep, absolutely. I agree. You are 100% being as helpful as you can. So, listeners, I'm going to close this stuff out. So for all of those competitive players that maybe got this shared or, you know, got it recommended when you're trying to figure out if you wanted to play this game, I hope you take a look at the game and realize that you can come up with some options that are just too OP.